This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello and welcome, everybody, to a new episode of the Urban Political. My name is Markus Kipp, and I'm joined by Ross Beveridge. And today we're talking about housing struggles in Berlin. It's a second part, it's a follow-up part to our previous episode, which talked about the rent cap legislation and its overturning with André Holm. And today we're talking, focusing on the grassroots campaign called Deutsche Wohnen und Co. Enteignen, a campaign to socialize corporately owned housing in Berlin. And we're talking to Joanna Kusiak, who is a research fellow in urban studies at King's College, Cambridge, and a visiting scholar at the Georg Simmel Center in Berlin at the Humboldt University. She is also an activist at this mentioned grassroots campaign, the Deutsche Wohnen und Co. Enteignen.
Hello.
Hi, Joanna. Great to have you. I'll turn it over to you with the first question to please tell us what this grassroots initiative Deutsche Wohnen und Co. Enteignen campaign is. And if you could talk about its aims and strategies or tactics.
So the initiative Deutsche Wohnen und Co. Enteignen, which literally means expropriate Deutsche Wohnen, and Deutsche Wohnen is just a name of the biggest privately owned stock-listed housing corporation in Berlin that owns over 100,000 apartments, just this one. So the campaign Expropriate Deutsche Wohnen und Co. and other corporations like that attempts to basically tackle housing crisis at its root, and the root is property relations. So instead, last week, I know there was an episode of a rent cap, and the initiative Expropriate Deutsche Wohnen is more about not just regulating rents, but really changing the basis of housing relation by deprivatizing housing that used to be public, but was then privatized in the course of the early 2000s, and therefore make sure it's long-term in the public domain. So that the struggle for better rents is not just reactive, but that people can actively shape the housing politics.
So maybe tell us a little bit about the history of the Deutsche Wohnen und Co. Enteignen.
So the initiative Deutsche Wohnen und Co. Enteignen really quite organically grew from a long-term engagement, long-term history of tenant activism in Berlin. Berlin is a rental city. Over 80% of housing is rental housing. And it also has this history of tenants mobilizing as a political force. I mean, suffice it to say that the first tenant movements in Berlin date back to 19th century. And of course, throughout Berlin's history, in West Berlin and East Berlin, we have had squatting movements, tenant mobilizations. So tenants have always been a political force in Berlin. And especially the last 10, 15 years, the rents in Berlin were growing not only much quicker than anywhere else in Germany, but in fact, relatively speaking, I think in 2018, the housing prices in Berlin grew the most in the whole world in the big cities. It was a big headlines in many news. Of course, that doesn't mean that housing in Berlin is more expensive than in London, but relatively speaking, the difference between what it used to cost and what it costs now was enormous and affected the population a lot also, because Berlin is not a rich city in terms of the earning power of its population. And why was this suddenly deep? I mean, on the one hand, we have to do with the usual, unfortunately, usual processes of financialization of housing, of speculation with housing, of international investors using housing the way that gold used to be used, namely as a storage for capital, as a mechanism for capital increase and speculation. But at the same time, specifically within Berlin, the fact that beyond regular landlords, we all of a sudden had this corporate stock-listed landlords, that really changed the game. Because Berlin, having this history of tenant movements, also, relatively speaking, when we compare in Europe, or especially when we compare with the Anglo-Saxon context, it always prided itself with reasonably good tenant protections, and there were always ways to try to legally fight back through the tenants associations, which are basically in its virtue legal associations. However, when this big corporation started buying when the big housing portfolios were privatized to this corporation, the game has really changed because of the change in scale. Because as much as if we think of the regular landlord, let's say someone who owns one or two tenant houses, and in the basics still considers tenant as his client, the corporate landlord plays completely different game. First, because these are stock-listed companies, and that means that the primary market for them is a financial market. What they primarily care is that their shareholders get returns on the capital. So in this sense, these are the shareholders and not the tenants that are the clients of those landlords, corporations. And that means that in some sense, no matter what the dynamic on the housing market, they have to push the rents up and they have to push the costs down. And it's not because, I don't know, they're not nice, they're evil people, it's just structural. And I think this is important to acknowledge it. This is a structural feature of a stock-listed landlord, that the housing dynamic, the dynamics of the housing market is completely secondary. Of course, it helps them that there's also high demand on housing, but just by virtue of the markets that they operate on, the financial market, they have to keep pushing the rents up. At the same time, they became way more effective in pushing the rents up because of their scale. So first, these corporations have their own legal departments where they hire very well paid lawyers whose day job is technically to find always new loopholes in the tenant laws. And therefore, the old ways of protecting yourself as a tenant stop working, or the game was really apt, because all of a sudden you really have professional lawyers on the other side that really try to make sure these rent regulations are not as effective as it used to be. But also they have different scale, which means that they can influence different benchmarks. For example, one of the typical benchmark in Berlin is so-called Mieterspiegel, so like a rent mirror, which is a benchmark that says what is the average rent in the city or in the given area of the city. And if a corporation like Deutsche Wohnen or Vonovia, Achilles, if they really own thousands of apartments in the same area, that means that if they increase rents in all of them, even a little bit, they influence the whole rent mirror. So they can also change the whole game of how and the dynamics of the rent prices. And so after years of different initiatives trying to protect tenants, where the activists were also gaining a lot of legal knowledge on the way, also through early experiences with public referenda and the mechanisms of direct democracy, in some sense, the activists realized that if we only focus on the tenant law and on the rent regulations, in some sense, with those corporations, we will always be on the defensive. Because even if we come up with a new solution, and that was exactly the case with Mietendeckel too. I mean, André Schulli mentioned last week that, you know, even if there's a new tool like a Mietendeckel, then the landlords, especially corporate landlords, immediately find a way to go around it, to question it legally, to basically find a way to still get their profits. And therefore, the only way to really tackle the housing crisis at its roots and for the long term is to change the property relations in the city and to revert this really harmful process of privatization of housing, because a lot of housing that we're now talking about in the context of this expropriation is housing that used to belong to public domain, that used to be municipal, or used to be this at least belong to this post-industrial housing. The big industry company in Germany, they also used to provide housing for the workers. But this were often housing that really was built as social housing. This includes also famous architectural gems in Berlin, the social housing from the 20s, that literally it is written on the wall that this is a housing that that is for social purpose, and now it's being used for profit. So the big question was, is it even possible? How is it possible to get so radical? And of course, initially, everyone thought it's one of these typical radical ideas. We all know that's what needs to be done, but it's so radical that it seems impossible, until a group of activists found Article 15 of the German Constitution. And Article 15 of the German Constitution is a, well, it's a Grundrecht, it's a basic law within the German Constitution that says that it is possible to socialize, and socialize is this word we're coming back to again and again, land, crucial branches of industry, or crucial natural resources for the purpose of common good. And the legal context is that this should serve the good of the society. And this is a very interesting legal clause, because it's a clause that is there in the Constitution. So as I said, it's a basic right. It's been there since the Constitution was written, but somehow it was completely forgotten. It was never used since the post-war period, like since the Constitution was written. There's no precedence, and many lawyers even implicitly, because not even explicitly, because no one was talking about it, but many lawyers even implicitly considered it some sort of a dead clause. And then some activists mentioned it, and at first, as far as I know, even within the activist environments, people were skeptical, like, is it really possible? But then it turned out it is. I mean, the legal concept of how it would be possible to expropriate or socialize this housing was first developed by a group of non-lawyer activists, which I think for me as a researcher is also a very interesting way of reclaiming the law from the grassroots up. And then when they showed this first draft, first project of how it could work to the lawyers, even lawyers were surprised that actually this is all possible. Legally speaking, this is all possible. And that's, in a way, is the biggest surprise of Berlin politics, I think, in decades, or since 1989.
Thanks, Johanna. So before we get on to talking about exactly what it is you want to do with this initiative, could you tell us a little bit more about the origins of it, and who exactly the co-op, what exactly the object is here, kind of like in a nutshell, in terms of how many flats are there? I think you touched on it already, and a little bit perhaps about the influence of other social movements or campaigns ongoing in Berlin. I mean, I was wondering a little bit about, you know, there's lots of campaigns against gentrification, against rising rental prices, but then the campaigns around remunicipalization of water and energy. I wonder if there's an influence there, even in terms of people being involved in it, who were involved in these earlier campaigns.
Definitely. As I mentioned before, I see Deutsche Wohnen, Co-Enteignen, as a step in the long history of Berlin's urban and social movements. And if you think in terms of the people, most of the core people, I mean, currently the initiative is also really growing, but most of the core people, especially the core people that were at the beginning, they have a history of engaging with all kinds of different initiatives, ones that include housing, like for example, Kotti & Co. or Mietvolksentscheid from years before, or Stadt von Unten. Then there are people who have experience with previous referenda, like the one about Tempelhof, the airport that is now turned into a public space. So definitely, this is possible because there's been a lot of gathering knowledge on the way and a lot of politicization. And I think it is crucial also because what is special, I think, about this initiative, but also about maybe Berlin social and urban movements in general, that this is not just a typical political protest movement. This is a movement that actively engages with the law. And that, well, I like to think about it, that it is a movement that is at the same time pro-systemic and anti-systemic. I mean, it's anti-systemic in a way of this basic claim, expropriate, let's change the structure that was produced by capitalism, let's expropriate this big corporate landlords, let's break the domination of capital. But at the same time, it's pro-systemic because it really actively tries to engage with the possibilities within the existing system, rather than wait till the revolution happens, so to say, and really create new institutions, because it's not just about expropriating these corporate landlords, but it's also about creating a new public institution that would manage this housing in a new and democratic way. And we're talking about a lot of apartments. It is currently estimated that this would affect around 200, at least 250,000 apartments in Berlin. I say at least and around because, to be honest, no one knows it for sure. Also because of how financial capital operates in the city. Namely, there are some corporations like Deutsche Wohnen, Achilles, Vonovia, that are the properties that we know about it. And it's clear that that is big corporations. But there are also corporations that use shell companies and shell subsidiaries to hide their own scales. And one prominent example is PES International. It's a British, global corporation, but that is owned by a prominent British family. That owns also like thousands of apartments, but they don't operate under their own name. They operate through these small subsidiary shell companies that are, most of them, they are taxed and formally based in Luxembourg. And it was through a journalistic investigation that Berlin has got to know who is behind these properties, because they were known in Berlin as a so-called Briefkastenfirmen. This means post box companies, because often from a tenant's perspective, you don't really know who your landlord is. You have a name and you have an address of a post box in Luxembourg, but it's not even like a formal headquarters, but just a post box. And there was, through some friend activists in Berlin, someone photographed this post box. There's literally a physical mailbox with, I don't know, several, at least 60 or 70 stickers with names of this company, which in a physical way illustrates that we're talking big capital here that hides itself under smaller share companies. And this might not be a singular case. So in the process, we might find out it's more apartments, but this is at least 250,000 apartments in the city. So this is a very significant portfolio, and this is the scale that allows politically to really imagine housing in a new way, which includes also ecological politics, sustainable politics, renewable energy, solar panels on the rooftop, social policies, making sure that housing is evenly distributed without discrimination, that, that housing needs are met, that old people have accessible housing, and so on and so on. So this is really an opportunity, again, not just to expropriate big corporations, but really to reimagine the distribution of housing in Berlin in a way that is more equitable and ecologically sustainable.
Thanks for that. So these companies were previously public, and I think they were privatized, so many of them in the early 2000s by, so I think, Social Democrat, Left Party coalition government. And the interesting, or one of the interesting things about the initiative is that it doesn't just want to take them back into the hands of the state. It has a different kind of vision of how housing housing should be owned and managed and kind of co-produced. Could you describe to us the plans, you know, the vision there of the initiative?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think for the English speaker, one way to think about what they're trying to do is, like, on the one hand, you could think it's like nationalization from the grassroots up, in the sense that you want to expropriate this property, but it does not happen by the top-down state. It really happens by the grassroots movement. So it's coming from below. And therefore, actually, it is not nationalization, but it's socialization. And socialization is, I know it's not a word that is known to an English-speaking audience, but it is a concept of a commonly owned property. And this concept includes not just ownership, and not just the fact that it is publicly owned, but also ways of management. So it needs to be democratically managed in a way that is participatory. So it cannot be just owned by the state in this very classical way, where you have this centrally managed state companies that I criticize it, that often identified in the popular imagination, public properties often identified with this really inflexible, slightly authoritarian, top-down state companies. This is not what the initiative has in mind here. What we have in mind is basically a new publicly owned institution, and the legal form is in German Anstalt öffentlicher Recht. Again, there's no direct translation of what would be, because it's a quirky, its own German legal form. But what this legal form allows is definitely to build in several legal protections within its form that protect from overusing the power of management, that makes sure there's democratic control of the decision-making process, that also there's a possibility, and definitely that's what the movement is striving for, of blocking the possibility of future privatization. So the idea is to really now, this time round, keep this housing long-term in the public domain. And the idea is to, a mixture between representation and participation. So this is a lot of housing, and it's spread around Berlin. So there would be some district councils, and there would be main board of this new housing body. And the idea, which is maybe slightly similar to how it is in English context with community land trust, is that the decision power is divided between, on the one hand, representatives of the tenants who are living in this property, but also representatives of Berlin populations who are not living in this housing. And this is important, because in this way, you can prevent it from becoming a club, you know, which sometimes happened to let's say some of the cooperatives, that they're great places to live for people who are already members, but it's impossible for anyone else to get into this privilege of housing that they offer. So the idea is that, because it affects so much of the city, that also people who are not living there, but are Berliners also would have influence in what's going on, and also representatives from Berlin Senate and representatives from the management of this company, administrative workers. So, so there would be this balance between having having a representation to make the decisions, but also having the instruments of direct democracy. I also encourage, because of course there's not there's only so much details one can tell in the format of a podcast, but also encourage to visit, especially those who speak German, the webpage of Deutsche von Neigungen, because there's a brochure there called Vergesellschaftung that describes in particular in detail the institutional structure of this new housing company. And I myself also try to describe it a little bit more in detail in an English article that's available online. So I think this is really interesting, because this is a way of experimenting. Now speaking more as a scholar, this is a way of experimenting with a new property form in the spirit of Elinor Ostrom, where you really think the ownership and the management together. Ostrom's thesis basically is that to really have commons or forms of common property to work, you need to basically think together or design together modes of ownership and modes of management of this property. That management is a part of property design, and that's definitely the case here with the initiative.
Let's talk a bit about the current political moment. And we've heard in the previous podcast, well, that the rent cap legislation has been overturned. That was reducing the rents for hundreds of thousands of Berliners and was protecting against excessive rents. So this law has been overturned, and we've already heard from André Holm last week that the rent cap legislation was in part also justified publicly by the Social Democrats as a way to prevent expropriation or socialization campaigns from happening. So now, with the current situation of the rent cap being overturned, tell us what the current prospect or the current campaign of the Deutsche Wohnen and Co. and Eichmann stands at and is up against or up for.
It's very interesting to think expropriation and Mietendeckel together. In a sense, we see Mietendeckel, the rent cap, almost as it emerges initially as a side effect of our initiative, because the rent cap was proposed by activists already years before. Before it was actually implemented, and the government, especially SPD, always argued that rent cap is too radical. This is not, this is basically a communist solution. This is often an easy way to discredit. And then in 2019, especially beginning of 2019, where the expropriation initiative really got a lot of media attention, the first surveys appeared showing that basically in some surveys, slightly over 50% of Berliners supported. So this is amazing. This is for a radical initiative like this. I think this surprised even the activists themselves. How ready Berlin it is for that in some sense. And that, of course, scared the real estate lobby, and it scared the real estate lobby within the parties too. Definitely rent cap was seen as reaction to this. I myself, as part of my fieldwork research, I interviewed one of the lawyers that participated in designing the Mietendeckel. And in this interview, she was quite open about the fact that she also sees Mietendeckel as a side effect of the expropriation initiative. So there was never the aim of the initiative, but I think the initiative helped the Mietendeckel to arise. I think it's still good that it was there for a year, especially that it coincided with COVID. And it, in a way, it showed how important it is. But now, of course, the fact that it was legally overturned, in some sense, I mean, on the one hand, it is, and it has to be said, it is tragic, especially in the COVID year, because people who partly lost their income, they also now have to pay back the debts that all of a sudden they have towards the landlord. At the same time, this decision really shows that there is no sustainable alternative to expropriation. And the funny fact in this case is that from the very beginning, it was fairly clear that although socialization of housing, expropriation / socialization of housing seems more radical, it is actually legally less controversial than the rent cap. That's how law often operates. This is because of how competencies are divided, but this is also because of the fact that socialization is really grounded in the German constitution, which is in Germany is called the basic law. The constitution is called the basic law. And in this sense, it's almost like the strongest possible legal base for something to happen on some level. So this is one thing. And the second thing, that the fact that this Article 15 of the Constitution was never used before also means that there are no precedents. So it's really like a legally open tabula rasa. Whereas with rent cap, of course, there's all kinds of precedents of who can do what. And again, there's also this issue, Andre surely explained it in detail in the last episode. The issue of the Mietendeckel ultimately was about competencies. So it was not that Mietendeckel as such wouldn't be possible. It is that it was Land Berlin that in this particular circumstance seemed not to be legally, should not have a legal power to do it, because it was already similar thing was already done on the similar but less radical thing was done on the national level. This again is not the case in terms of socialization, because on the federal level there's no legislation on socialization. It is legally quite clear that Berlin as a land in the federal system would have legal powers to do it. So there is no problem with no potential problem with expropriation having similar problems as the rent cap had. Legally, it's more radical, but it's more legally safe.
Joanna, can you tell us a bit more about the current situation in which the signatures are being collected and the referendum is being organized? Tell us a bit more about the process and where it's what its outlooks are.
So as we're doing this recording in April, we are really halfway in the process of collecting signature. The law foresees that for this referendum to happen, the initiative needs to collect around 170,000 valid signatures within 4 months. And the countdown of this 4 months started in February and goes till roughly mid-June. And we are already in a halfway. We have collected more than half of the needed signatures, although we're still in the process, or the Senate is still in the process of proving the validity, what is the exact number of the valid signatures. This is an issue in Berlin because, legally speaking, the only valid signatures are won by German citizens who are registered in Berlin. And this is in itself a political problem that we also speak to, because Berlin is a fairly cosmopolitan international city, which means a lot of people who are affected by the housing situation do not happen to have Berlin citizenship. And they often sign, nonetheless, they sign the petition as well as a political gesture. And we also collect and count the signatures, even if they're legally not valid, just to make a point that there's this whole population in Berlin of Berlin citizen, of tenants that just do not happen to be German citizens. So this, but this were another, like what I wanted to say, that it seems that the collection of signatures is doing very well, especially if we consider the fact that this first 2 months of collecting signature, we have to do a very strict lockdown because of COVID. The weather has not been too good, which also, of course, makes it difficult. There's less people outside. And nonetheless, the signature collection process is going well. And I think especially since the legal decision about Mietendeckel, we also see more anger and more political mobilization because people are frustrated with the situation on the housing market. They really counted on Mietendeckel. Many people counted on Mietendeckel. Mietendeckel has made the situation easier in the times of Corona, and now they are frustrated. So the more willing they are to go the radical way. So I think in some sense, it increases the unfortunate legal decision about the Mietendeckel, definitely increases the sense of urgency around expropriation.
So I don't know if you covered it already, but so you need to collect these signatures. It's a slightly complicated process, isn't it? So you need to, there's certain hurdles you have to sort of jump over. And at the moment, you're kind of trying to get over the hurdle to do what, to present to force a debate in the Berlin Senate, in the Berlin government about this initiative. Is that the step that we're at now? And that would then force then some kind of legislation ultimately on your initiative.
So what would happen is that once we collect enough valid signatures, then it will be, a referendum would be organized. And in terms of dates, currently the way it looks like, it is very probable that this referendum would happen on the same day as the Bundestag election. This is again great news because typically with referenda, the problem with referenda is not getting enough yes votes, but it's about getting enough people to participate and to get the quorum. And of course, if the referendum is on the day where people anyway go to vote for the Bundestag election, we could expect that there will be a high turnout for voters. So again, this is from this perspective, this is looking good. And then let's assume hypothetically that that everything goes well, that the signatures are collected, the referendum happens, enough people vote yes. So Berliners decide, yes, let's socialize this housing. Then it will be up to Berlin Senate to propose to write a law that basically enforces this socialization. Because it still needs to happen through a law, and according to Article 15, such law still needs to be written by Berlin's government. And in this respect, referendum is not legally binding, in the sense that the socialization doesn't happen automatically just by virtue of the results of a referendum. But referendum is, of course, politically binding. It did not happen in the history of Berlin, in particular, that the direct democracy's strongest mechanism, which is the referendum, was used, and then the government dares to not stick to its result. Of course, that would still mean there would be a process of intense political negotiation about what is the exact shape of this law, how this law is written. There's a lot of legal technicalities always in the game, and surely that would not be an easy negotiation. The initiative also proposed its own project of such law that is available also online. So there will be this whole legal discussion. And the second big legal discussion that would happen after the referendum, after people win the referendum, is the question of compensation. And this is, of course, a very important part of the current debate. Namely, from a legal point of view, it's clear that expropriating this corporation would mean that the City of Berlin also needs to compensate them. However, it is not legally predetermined how high this compensation would be. So from the purely legal point of view, compensation could be anywhere from 1 euro to, let's say, 1 euro beyond the market price. This is important because this definitely cannot legally, there would be really legally questionable to compensate on the market prices, as it sometimes happens with a regular expropriation where you buy something to build a highway, because legally then this would not count as socialization. The idea of socialization is really to break the quasi-monopoly of a private big-scale owner for the good of the society, and therefore just buy back on market price would not count as socialization. So the only thing that is legally clear is that the compensation would be below the market prices, but then that can mean anything. As I said, like 1 euro is also, you know, it doesn't seem politically probable, but we can also think back to the time where very attractive properties in formerly East Germany were privatized for 1 Deutsche Mark, symbolically. So it's not that there are not historical precedents for it. And then there's many different calculations of how much this compensation could be. And it is really a political decision, because for the compensation, again, there would be a new law that would need to be drafted by the Senate. And so this would be a political decision to make. And as it is a political decision, it also depends a lot on different pressures. So there surely will be pressure from real estate lobby to make this compensation very high, but there surely also will be a lot of pressure from Berlin citizen to make sure that it does not break the city's budget. So that's one of the big discussions. This discussion is often used by the opponents of the initiative, who try to scare off the potential supporters by saying that such compensation would need to be super expensive and this would break the city budget. This really does not need to, this is not the case. A, because it does not need to be that high, and B, because it would be probably financed with credit that would be in the long term repaid with the income from rents from the socialist apartments, because even if this apartment will be back in public hands, and even if this means that the rents in them will be kept at the reasonably low level, this way or another, this apartment still bring in income, and this income would not be profit, because this would be a non-profit operated housing company, but precisely this income would be used on the one hand to modernize existing housing stock, on the other hand to build new housing stock. And this is also part of the idea, to make sure to use this income from rents to keep increasing the public housing stock in Berlin, but also you can use it to repay the credit that and also and also to modernize, to improve the quality of this housing.
I mean, a lot of the areas we've covered in the last hour seem quite specific to Germany. We think about the legal aspects there, and also this process of direct democracy, this referendum possibility, which you don't have in other places. But what do you think initiatives in other parts of the world might take from what's happening in Berlin, and particularly in relation to the socialization of housing movement?
Well, I think the Berlin initiative is, in some sense, a wonderful practical realization of the principle of think globally, act locally, because on the one hand, this initiative is, because it runs through law, is very specific, because law is always specific to given jurisdiction. At the same time, the property in question is global. I mean, if you think who are the shareholders of those corporations, there are the financialization's usual suspects. We have BlackRock, Blackstone, different international funds, So it is not even on that level, on this direct property level, this is not just purely Berlin Mathe. And there's an international capital behind it. And if this international capital, if the housing stock owned by international capital is expropriated in Berlin, this still creates a wonderful precedent and probably the first case in the world of this scale where grassroots initiative, local grassroots initiative, really manages to break the power of big capital. And this opens the whole new world of possibilities. And while, of course, the German constitution is valid only in Germany and certain legal conditions or even legal and political conditions are not directly transplantable from one place to another, this would really change the global imagination about what is possible. And also why this laws might not exist in other places. Law is also a function of politics, and there would be definitely that could start also push for new legislation of different kinds that would differ in detail, but that would have similar intention in mind, I'm sure. Plus, I think it encourages, I think on the more abstract level, I think what this initiative does is really encourages in political movements everywhere to seek solutions in places that, well, maybe are not immediately obvious. Because, again, you're speaking as a scholar, and one of the main theme of my research is questions of politics and law, and to which extent law can be used and appropriated for the purposes of progressive politics, knowing that law is in its origins and its functioning, in some sense, a very conservative institution. But still, it, as much as neoliberalism uses legal technicalities to push ahead its own agendas of privatization, of financialization, in principle, similar strategic move can be achieved from also by a grassroots socially minded initiative. This is, of course, not an easy thing, but it's possible, and this initiative illustrates that this is possible.
I'd like to hear a bit about the opponents of this campaign, because surely there are plenty. Could you tell us a bit about their main lines of attack against this initiative, and what is to be expected from them, maybe?
Of course, I mean, I think quite unquestionably the main opponent of the initiative is a real estate lobby, and this that operates on different scales. So on one hand, we have these corporations themselves, of course, that are trying to defend themselves. Then we have the real estate lobbyists and lobbyist moves that try to influence what the dynamics of the parties and the dynamics of political decisions. And then we have a global capital that, as I explained, is involved in all this. And I think one of the interesting example of how the power tools of global capital are being mobilized, we saw also in 2019, again, after the surveys were published that showed that more than 50% of Berliners support the expropriation initiative. Very quickly, the international rating agency Moody published a paper that basically threatens to downgrade Berlin as a place for investment and in this rating system if Berlin dares to expropriate those corporations. And interestingly enough, so we as initiative, we or one of our activists bought this paper, because of course it's behind firewalls, it's quite expensive. But we spent this 400 euros to see this paper, and it's literally, it's not even a full page. It's basically around three paragraphs with no argumentation whatsoever. So this is not an analysis. This is purely a PR move, and it worked as a PR move because, of course, it made headlines in many local newspapers. Berlin will be downgraded. But it is clear that this is not based. I mean, once you see what's written there, This is not based on any analysis. This is a power move by global capital that felt threatened by this possibility of expropriation. And to be honest, the more initiative gains steam now and the more the vision of expropriation becomes real, the more I expect that we will see more and more of those moves, where it's not only the Berlin community, but also international capital and international institution of power that uphold the power of capital will be finding different ways through black PR, through probably trying to discredit individual activists and so on and so on. I think it would be stupid to expect that this would all go smoothly without some major power backlash, because we're really talking billions and billions of euros, 250,000 apartments. This is really huge amount of capital that could be lost for the private profit, and they're not gonna be happy about it. They're not gonna give it back easily. So these are the opponents, and therefore it's also important to build support. And so now that we said about the opponents, it's also important to say a little bit more about the supporters of the initiative, because it's not, it is this grassroots initiative with lots of individual supporters, but there's also more and more institutional supporters that join us. And just to name a few, I mean, there's more than that, but the unions, Verdi, for example, one of the biggest German unions, is now officially supporting and collecting signatures with us. Also because from their perspective, I mean, not only it is important for workers of all kinds to have access to cheap housing, but also these big corporations do not treat their own workers too well. They don't hold up to the union negotiated tariffs and so on and so on. So the union supporters, the tenants organization supports us. Some ecological movements are supporting us also, because shifting this amount of housing to the public domain also opens new way of adjusting the city to better tackle the climate crisis. And this is partly also happening in the municipally owned housing in Berlin, that in a coordinated way, you could imagine mounting solar panels on this amount of rooftops in Berlin to create, as we call it, tenant electricity. And also to modernize, I mean, in Berlin, till now, often thermal modernizations of insulation of buildings had a really bad name among the tenants, because it was often used as a pretext to get rid of tenants or massively increase rents. If housing would be in the public domain, this would be the ecological modernization of housing would also be possible on the bigger scale and in a way that is fair to the tenants. So therefore also ecological movements support us. A lot of local businesses support us, little shops, because again, we focus on housing, but most of these buildings also have some sort of shops or service spaces downstairs on the ground floor. And through increasing of private rents, we also saw in Berlin how a lot of small businesses, local shops, local cafes, traditional places have been gradually disappearing and being replaced by chain supermarkets, bank filiales, and so on. And therefore, little shop owners tend to also be interested in supporting us. So there's really city-wide mobilization of people who I think also become more and more aware that what always made Berlin special in terms of atmosphere, in terms of its very urban promise of offering opportunities for experimentation, that all is being threatened by this radically rising rents. And even if one thinks from more surprising angles, not only from this classical socially minded actors, but even if we think from the perspective of startups and business development, the point is that to start a startup, you need to be able to risk. And if people do not have stable living situation, if they have to, let's say, buy housing and live on mortgage, they're less willing to take a risk. So all kinds of both artistic and business experimentation that Berlin made possible is being threatened by rising rents. So I think people are really becoming aware that the socialization is a unique historical opportunity to save the promise of Berlin.
So last but not least, Joanna, if you could maybe tell us a bit or reflect on your position as both a researcher on the Deutsche Wohnen und Co. and Eignen, as well as an activist. So how do you combine these two positions, and how do you make engagements in either field fruitful or important for the other?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for this question. I mean, in some sense, maybe by way of an anecdote, I almost consider the initiative Deutsche Wohnen und Eignen as a present I got for my research, because I've been researching this intersection of law and urban politics, urban movement for a while. I'm originally from Warsaw, and I used to be also an urban activist in Warsaw, so I have a history of trying to handle research and activism together, or trying to research on the topics that are, let's say, at least politically relevant. And my research on Warsaw mostly showed and explored, in the context of property restitution in Warsaw, how legal technicalities were used to take over public property and exploit it for profit. And as the core of this research was about how these legal technicalities can be employed for political purposes, in this case for neoliberal, or profit-oriented purposes, I started to think, okay, to see these legal technicalities more as a neutral tools, and start to wonder, could we really do the other way around? I mean, if we can manipulate rhetorically with these legal argumentations, could we try to do, is it viable within the legal system to try to do it otherwise and use these different legal technicalities to push ahead more progressive social agendas? And initially, when I was writing the project application for Cambridge, what I had in mind was indeed researching Berlin and more the tenant association, how they legally argue in the courts. And after I got my project funded, all of a sudden the Deutsche Wohnen und Co. and Eignen happened. So in some sense, I was almost amazed that after I already wrote my research project, I was handed over by reality of Berlin. I was handed over a wonderful, beautiful case study that is alive and that it's happening as I'm researching. So this was also a researcher luck in some sense that I got this initiative. And at first I started as a researcher, I contacted the movements, I started to attend the meetings, also to see, to find answers to my research questions, how those people handle the law, how they shape the legal debate, how they think about the law, the whole process, and also this interactions between law and politics, both in a big structural sense, but also in this everyday negotiations that happen between the political and the legal level. And because I do have an activist soul, and because the more I researched the initiative, the more I was convinced by the validity and the value of the approach. And also because I am a Berliner myself, I lived here since 2007, I had my own issues with my landlord, who is not a corporation, by the way. But I know the game. It seemed to me that it would be unthinkable almost not to join, in a sense, also to miss this historical opportunity to participate, but also from this sense of duty that certain type of expertise that I have also might be useful because I do research on law, because and politics, my expertise also might be potentially useful for the movement. So that's how I end up in this conflation of being a scholar activist in this Berlin case. And
Joanna, thanks very much for that, for finishing on that personal note, and for the brilliant insights on the Deutsche Wohnen & Co. Enteignen campaign and housing politics more generally. I think we've learned a lot, and let's hope you get the signatures. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks to you for listening. For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.